Welcome to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the big stories and top investment ideas from the Eurozone and Switzerland. After weeks of fast-moving developments in the Middle East, the US and Iran have reached an agreement aimed at ending the conflict. While some setbacks are likely, the situation is moving toward greater stability, and investors are now focused on the outlook for shipping through the Strait of Hormuz and the broader impact on markets. So the key questions now are, how quickly will shipping improve? Which sectors or companies have been hit the hardest, and where do we see the strongest potential for recovery? I'm Belinda Ulander. To help unpack these questions, we're joined today by our chief economist, Paul Donovan, and my co-host, Chris Swan. In this episode, we discuss what the latest developments mean for investors, the impact on central bank policy, and why diversification remains central as the global investment landscape becomes less predictable. So, Chris, let's kick it off with the first question.
So first question is on the Middle East, and obviously this has been, events have continued to move very, very quickly, and obviously with quite significant potential spillover to the global economy and Europe. But what is your sense of the state of play and how shipping is starting to open up through the Strait and what that means?
Well, yeah, it is, as you say, a fast-moving situation. What I would say is that the direction of travel does seem to be fairly clear. So we're going to get setbacks along the way, but I think we are moving towards a solution which will, in very, very simplistic terms, probably not be that different to the deal that President Obama struck with Iran. So something along those lines, probably with some further concessions on frozen Iranian assets, and I think probably tolls on shipping going through Hormuz. Now, they won't be called tolls, they'll be called something different, environmental charges perhaps, or tariffs, something along those lines. And I think whilst it's not going to be a smooth passage, what that means is we should be expecting a slow, gradual improvement in the volume of shipping going through Hormuz. It's sort of like a ratchet effect. Once you've moved forwards a certain amount, yes, you might go back a bit, but you're not going to go back all the way. So we continue to progress in the general direction of some kind of normalization. Now, normalization up to a point. I mean, you know, we've still got to see reconstruction take place in the Gulf region. For example, there is damage to facilities. Very hard to know what that damage is because, you know, satellite imaging is restricted. You know, in some of these countries, you take a photograph of a damaged building on your phone, you're liable to be arrested. I mean, you know, there's no real sense. But there is clearly going to be something that has to happen. And so there will be some disruption. But for me, the direction of travel is clear.
And looking more specifically at markets, there's also been a lot of discussion about who stands to benefit or lose from these recent developments. So how have different regions like Europe, the US and Asia been affected? And also given Europe's reliance on imported energy, what kind of sectors or companies do you think were hit the hardest, and where would you see the strongest potential for recovery?
That's an interesting question because what we have seen, and I don't want in any way to sort of diminish the cost of the conflict that we've had, particularly in human terms, but from an economic point of view, it's been a bit of a phony war. Because yes, we did get a spike higher in energy prices, of course, but we haven't seen demand be affected. Consumers across the developed world have scaled back their levels of saving, their savings rates, and used the reduced savings rate as a cushion with which to then go out and maintain their levels of consumption. So why does that matter? Well, that matters because what we've generally seen in Europe, for example, is companies being able to pass on the oil cost increases. And in most cases, the oil cost increases have been passed on pretty quickly, but then not experience any negative demand shock in response. So that leaves us with a situation where the damage from all of this is muted. And therefore, the response to an easing of the situation is muted. The problem with the whole situation in the Gulf was if this had gone on for a further 6 months, then we would have had a lot more disruption. Then we would have had a lot more shift. If we think about, you know, who may now benefit in a post-war environment, I think, you know, at the risk of stating the obvious, the Middle East is going to have to engage in both reconstruction and rearmament. And I think in both of those areas, what that will probably do is, certainly at the margin, tend to favour Europe and Asia over the United States. Now, reconstruction spending tends to favour Europe and Asia anyway. You don't import cement to Saudi Arabia from the United States. That would be a remarkably foolish thing to be doing. So, you know, you've automatically got just geographic proximity assisting here. But then on top of that, when we think about the rearmament, the changing political relationships, the damage to trust in the United States and so on that we have seen in the region, that means, I think, that we might see rearmament perhaps more focused on drones from Ukraine than missiles from the United States, to put it in simplistic terms. So I think that that probably offers a degree of benefit to Europe and to Asia in a relative sense, at the very least.
Yeah, and I guess going firmly back onto your area of expertise, central banking, one of the big worries through the crisis has been the potential for higher energy prices spilling over into accelerating inflation and from there to tighter central bank policy. Perhaps you can just focus partly on the ECB in this regard, but it does seem that the risk of a more aggressive tightening cycle seems to have faded.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. The markets got very worked up about this. Economists generally did not, because economists weren't seeing any of this spillover effect, second round effects, as we call it. So as I said earlier, we have seen the oil price pass through fairly quickly. If you've got higher oil costs, you've pushed this onto the consumer because the consumer's been expecting it. And so you've had energy surcharges on taxis in Chicago or on deliveries in the UK. You've had higher electricity prices and so on and so forth. So that direct effect has been very, very obvious and very, very quick. But we haven't seen the wage price spiral concerns. We haven't seen particularly episodes of profit-led inflation. All of that just hasn't happened. And I think the problem here is that the bond markets in particular were rather naively sort of trying to view policy through the experience of 2022. And the world today is nothing like what it was in 2022. So you'll get a different reaction function. What's now happened, I think, is that firstly, obviously, the headline oil prices, the oil futures have been coming down. And so that's revised some of the expectations. But also, because we haven't had the second round effects, the inflation numbers from Europe in particular, and also the United States to some extent, have been coming in lower than expected. Now we've got, you know, tariffs and other things that complicate the US picture a little bit. But basically, the inflation numbers have been coming in lower than expected. And we're going back to a more realistic assessment that you've had a one-off energy shock and you haven't had the second round effects. Now, of course, the ECB has raised rates. And it raised rates by a quarter point, which is not necessarily that significant economically. I would regard this as a policy error. I think this is a completely unnecessary move. But the problem is that there is a faction within the ECB, let us call it the Bundesbank faction for the sake of simplicity, where, you know, it doesn't matter what is happening in the world. The response of the Bundesbank faction is, well, we should raise rates. That's the solution. Doesn't matter what it is. The solution is always to raise rates. And so there was that sort of instinctive response. But what we're now hearing, of course, is, you know, Lagarde, at the recent ECB summer camp for central bankers, was coming out and saying, yes, well, you know, now the risks are broadly balanced. I mean, my problem with her statement is, well, the risks were broadly balanced 20 days ago. Things don't change that quickly in the world of economics, and yet you were still committing a policy error and raising rates 20 days ago. So, you know, the fact that there's more public recognition that there really isn't a threat is perhaps a more positive sign.
And speaking about Europe, there's also been a renewed focus on structural reform in Europe since, given the Draghi report about 2 years ago. Are we seeing any real progress there, or is it mostly just headlines?
Well, we are seeing some attempts to integrate in Europe. So one of the comments that you quite often hear, and one of the things that has been a focus of the Commission, is that in the late 90s in particular, Europe was really working to integrate its economies further, to create a more powerful single market, and to move to a more integrated economic structure. And the culmination of that was the euro. And then after the euro had been introduced, everyone sort of sat back and said, oh, well, that's done. Let's relax for a bit. Let's just consolidate. Let's not go any further. Big thing has happened. Let's sit back. And they've sort of sat back for 26 years. Now, what is now happening is an attempt to try and integrate a bit further. So to regain some of that momentum, to stop standing still. And so we're seeing things like attempts to create European corporate governance structures, a European regulatory structure for companies. And what I think is quite an interesting way of trying to move forwards on this is to add an extra layer of regulation, which doesn't sound like a good thing, but it probably is. Because what Europe is saying is, look, okay, we've got 27 different national regulations and they're all, incompatible and they don't really work very well together. What we're going to do is add, on top of that, a European standard regulation which applies across all 27 countries. And so if, let us say, you are looking to set up a business and you want to set up a business in France, you would have the choice. Do you set up a business in France under French regulation, or do you choose the pan-European regulation, which you can then take and operate in any other country? And I think over time, sort of natural selection when survival of the fittest will work. And what you will see is actually you will not force change on the national regulations, not force integration on the national regulations, but people just won't use the national regulations and they will go to the pan-European standard. And you get more integration. You start to get European champions rather than national champions. You move in the right direction. So this is something where there is real momentum. There's a lot of expectation that this sort of pan-European ideal will be taking on real life in the early part of 2027. Let's see. I mean, always a little dangerous to project these things, particularly with Europe. But I think it is moving in the right direction and we'll see some of these things emerging.
Yeah, I mean, can you narrow in slightly on Germany? Because obviously we've had a flurry of headlines over recent days regarding potential, we should say, like a re-acceleration in the German reform momentum. What can we expect from that?
The German situation, we have to remember that the German economy has the headwind of a declining population. So, we should not be getting too worked up about the headline GDP rate, because if you've got a falling population, you've got a drag on your headline GDP rate automatically. GDP per capita fares a little better. The focus is to try and improve the efficiency of the German economy within a European context. My perception over the years is that part of the problem is that, again, Germany stopped innovating. It stopped moving forwards. I mean, if you look, a lot of its heavy industries are using quite antiquated techniques, quite out-of-date techniques. As a student of British economic history, we've seen this before in other countries like the UK, where you have a wonderfully successful technique and it's world class, and you cling to that because it's world class, and you fail to realise that the rest of the world has moved on without you, and they're no longer interested in the fact that your world class chemical production ideas from the 1920s are not necessarily quite so relevant in the 2020s. So I think that the what Germany needs, and what we're starting to see some of, is an attempt to shake things up and to jolt parts of the German economy out of a complacency that really isn't deserved. So there is, I think, movement in this regard. There are going to be certainly attempts to improve innovation, to look at new ways of developing growth. We've had some moves in this with some of the shocks that we've had, particularly the Russia-Ukraine war, when Russia invaded Ukraine and we saw the disruption to gas supplies and the increase in gas prices. You know, Germany really went hard on improving energy efficiency in its industrial sector. I mean, really dramatic energy efficiency improvements, mainly through just changing working practices. And you know, the question is, well, why didn't you do this 20 years ago? And all of a sudden you get that competitive edge. There was also some business closure and some outsourcing of more energy intensive processes. But actually, it does show that with the right sort of incentive, you can really get things moving in quite a short space of time within the German economy.
So I guess that sort of raises the issue of some of the more innovative parts of the European economy and where you see that. I notice we've just finished the second quarter and the Stoxx 600 had its best quarter since 2020. And a lot of that was based on a sort of handful of technology companies in Europe. Obviously, that's not a sector that sort of looms large in Europe overall. But perhaps you can give us some thoughts on where you do see pockets of innovation in Europe.
Well, so the issue with innovation and technology, I always say, you know, I don't care about technology. Technology is largely irrelevant in the long term. You know, I mean, who cares who makes your smartphone? What matters is how you use it. The application of technology, that's where the real productivity gains, where the real value added comes in. That's what we need to be focused on. And here I think Europe does have some potential gains. The European education system, I think, for instance, produces a workforce that probably has a competitive advantage, certainly to that of the United States, when it comes to applying things like AI. It's got more people who are equipped to improve their productivity, to benefit from introducing AI, introducing other forms of technology into their day-to-day work routines. So I think there are plenty of positives that come through there. And so a lot of the innovation, it's not really the innovation of, oh, you've got a new designed chip or your data center is somehow superior. That's not the innovation that you necessarily are looking for. It's the innovative working practices that bring together human capital, the economic jargon term for people, alongside the potential productivity enhancement of applying technology.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I guess the green transition is also a big part of this whole structural reform plan. We've seen momentum slow at times, but also signs of renewed activity, especially with recent events like the conflict and also the heat wave that we're in. What do you think the current mood is right now around climate and energy policy in Europe?
Well, I mean, I think to a certain extent, energy policy is becoming a little bit irrelevant because, as you say, it's sort of a grassroots movement that people are saying, well, you know, of course I'm going to put solar panels on the roof of the house. And of course I'm going to add batteries to the solar panel system I installed 10 years ago. And of course, you know, with electricity prices going up, I'm going to find ways to mitigate that. We're seeing a lot more awareness of energy costs in Europe, particularly at the retail level. This is actually more of a global phenomenon, but I think it is something Europe is doubling down on because you start introducing smart meters into people's homes, all of a sudden, the cost of electricity is not something abstract you get upset about once a quarter when the bill shows up on your doorstep. It's something that you are sitting there, you know, eating your dinner in your kitchen and monitoring on a minute-by-minute basis. I may recently have acquired a smart meter. But what that does is it heightens the awareness and then it heightens the efficiency response to that. And when we're talking about the green energy transition, yes, it is about solar panels and wind turbines and so on and so forth. It's also about using what you already do more efficiently. I mean, this is all part of the process. So I think Europe has some advantages here. The slight concern, I wouldn't overplay this, but the slight concern that we do get in Europe is the anti-China sentiment occasionally resurging. And you know, maybe we should do something. China is dumping photovoltaic cells or batteries on Europe, et cetera, et cetera. I'm quite skeptical about this, I have to say, in terms of the dumping argument. It doesn't seem to me to be particularly well justified. But that sort of economic nationalism might put some sand in the gears a little bit in terms of the green energy transition. But I think fundamentally, this is not a policy-driven decision anymore. This is people voting with their wallets and doing it for themselves.
And perhaps to close, maybe we can sort of loop back a little to where we started, which is the US-Iran conflict. It seems like another episode that's put quite a bit of strain on the relationship between Europe and the US, which has, you know, long been very, very close and friendly. As Europe tries to find or tries to forge more strategic independence, how do you think investors should be viewing this?
Part of a wider global phenomenon, which is that in periods of economic uncertainty and economic stress, you will see a desire to find someone to blame, what we call scapegoat economics. Everything's going wrong. It's not my fault. I'm losing my job. It must be the fault of somebody else. It must be the fault of that group over there. And we're seeing economic nationalism, boundaries going up between established allies. You're not just with Europe. I mean, Brexit obviously was an example of economic nationalism, but you're also seeing this with hostility to China. You're seeing this with, you know, the extraordinary disputes within the NAFTA countries of North America, et cetera, et cetera. It's an ongoing theme. So I don't think we should look at the tensions between the US and Europe as being an isolated instance. What investors therefore need to think about is how do you work in a world where, you know, the inexorable march of globalization doesn't look quite so inevitable anymore. And I think that, you know, at the risk of sounding like every wealth manager ever, whoever's ever opined on this sort of thing, that the answer does have to be diversification, because it's very, very difficult to try and judge in advance, you know, where problems may bubble to the surface in 4 or 5 years' time. Having a diversified, geographically diversified portfolio, having diversification in terms of the sector exposure, provides you with a degree of hedging, because if something untoward, something entirely illogical and irrational happens, which targets a country in your portfolio or a sector of your portfolio, you will still then have insurance against this.
Thanks, Paul. That was really fascinating, as always. So hopefully you'll join us again soon.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for any more questions. But thank you so much for our listeners for tuning in. And thank you, Paul, for joining us again.
Thank you very much for your time.
Unfortunately, we can't delve into specific securities on these podcasts, but you can discuss some of these with your UBS representative. But just to quickly sum up, as Paul highlighted, periods of economic uncertainty and distress often lead to unpredictable shifts, whether it's political tensions, economic nationalism, or sudden changes in market dynamics. These risks are difficult to foresee and can affect regions or sectors in unexpected ways. That's why diversification remains essential for investors. By building a geographically and sector diversified portfolio, you gain a degree of protection against irrational or unforeseen events, whether it's from volatility, from geopolitical conflicts, shifts in energy prices, or structural changes in Europe. We'll be back soon with another installment of Across the Pond. Until then, have a great week.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.